This is an ABC podcast.
This is Pacific Beat on ABC Radio Australia. And coming up, Solomon Islands Prime Minister Rick Ho calls for stronger ties with Australia. Why Guam has more reason than most to celebrate the outcome of the US-North Korea summit. And we meet some very lucky children from the Pacific who are in Russia for the FIFA World Cup. Those stories to come a little later. Good morning, I'm Richard Hewitt. We start with the latest research on Papua New Guinea's economic links with China, which have identified a surge in aid spending from a cashed-up country seeking to extend its influence in the Pacific. It's reached the point now where China is matching Australian aid to PNG dollar for dollar, and with far fewer preconditions attached. But as Bill Bainbridge reports, a survey of former politicians, senior public servants and army officers, amongst others, has revealed some disquiet over what price PNG may have to pay for its aid down the track.
Chinese Foreign Minister Wang Yi has met with Papua New Guinea's Foreign Minister. Wang said over the past 42 years of diplomatic relations, the two countries have made substantial progress in various fields.
PNG Foreign Minister Rimbink Pato was in Beijing to meet his counterpart in April. It's a sign of the warming ties between the two countries ahead of Chinese President Xi Jinping's visit for APEC later this year. And the relationship includes more than just handshakes and photo opportunities, with development aid, by some measures, surging to $500 million a year. Professor Matthew Clark is one of a group of researchers who've investigated how the elites of Papua New Guinea view that aid money.
Well, they certainly recognise that the aid is different, that there is a difference between Chinese aid and Australian aid.
The researchers from Sydney and Deakin Universities spoke to 18 former politicians, public servants, activists, financial advisers, lecturers and others about their views on both Australian and Chinese aid.
They were able to identify that the motivation for Chinese aid is quite clear, that it's largely around locating new markets, but it is also about China trying to increase its influence in the region.
But they also recognise that Australia uses its aid budget to gain influence in PNG. And while Australia is seen as having a paternalistic approach, China provides few conditions on how their money is spent.
One of the respondents that spoke to us about it described Chinese aid as being much more masculine, that it was used to build things and deliver big infrastructure, and that might appeal to Papua New Guinea leaders given the culture of leadership within Papua New Guinea.
It begs the question as to whether Australia should offer untied aid as a way of competing with China's influence. But Bal Karma from the Australian National University cautions against that approach.
That was what used to happen before this current program of tied aid, before it was an untied aid. The problem that came out of that and was validly raised was the systemic accountability issues and corruption in the government, which continues to be an issue for PNG for a long time now.
Matthew Clark agrees and says that rather than ape the Chinese approach, Australia should look to improving what it does already and not imagine that its own aid is above reproach.
There was also a sense that when they compare it to Australian aid, they see Australian aid promised to Papua New Guinea and then being used to pay for Australian consultants or flows back out of Papua New Guinea back to Australia. And one of the people that we spoke to sort of questioned whether that was just as corrupt as Chinese aid. So there was quite a reasonable, nuanced understanding that aid has multiple purposes and therefore people in positions of power and influence can actually utilise either Australian aid or Chinese aid to their own benefit, perhaps ahead of that of their community. But it was recognised that there were flaws in both Australian aid programs and Chinese aid programs in that regard.
Professor Matthew Clark from Deakin University in Melbourne, ending that report from Bill Bainbridge. The Deputy Speaker of the Bougainville Parliament, Francesca Somoza, says a three-day conference on the forthcoming independence referendum hosted by PNG's National Research Institute has opened a lot of people's eyes. Ms. Somoza says it's clear the PNG government has to deliver on its funding promise for the ballot, and Prime Minister Peter O'Neill will be pressed on that issue when he visits the autonomous region next week.
And a blessing to actually hear factual and facts about what's really happening in Bougainville, what is actually lagging behind in terms of referendum ready. We're doing the best we can do, as leaders on the ground, as NGO on the ground. But from the national government, there isn't much support. So I believe and I have faith that after what happened in Port Moresby, I'm pretty sure the national government, the opposition as well, they now know about what's happening on the ground. It is in the peace agreement that the country is supposed to be helping Bougainville to get ready for referendum. And this is what was supposed to happen 15 years ago.
From the financial point of view, I know the feeling in Bougainville is that the PNG government have not delivered on financial support for the referendum in which they said that they would. Peter O'Neill is due in Bougainville in just a few days' time now. So is that an issue that will be brought to his attention once again on that occasion? And what sort of reception do you think Peter O'Neill is going to get in Bougainville now?
At his closing remarks, he said the government department is totally in support of making sure that all work progresses well and that we get our funding to complete and to make sure that awarenesses and everything done correctly on time. So I believe when it comes to Arawa next week, I'm pretty sure he has to make the commitment and actually make it happen and say, well, I'm ready, here's the money. The reception that the PM will get in Bougainville, I'm pretty sure will be positive. We are peace-loving people. We understand the frustrations, and I don't believe there's going to be anything bad in terms of demonstration happening. I wouldn't expect anything like that.
If the result of the referendum is a vote for independence, how confident are you that the O'Neill government won't simply veto that vote? Because while he's saying the referendum will go ahead and he's backing the process of the referendum, he's also saying that the government of Papua New Guinea will have the final say, and some might interpret that as a bit of a threat.
The most important thing for any responsible government to do is to let the people of Bougainville take that vote. Let them complete the process. Only when the process is completed, then we know what people's wishes are in Bougainville. And if people of Bougainville vote like 95% for independence, then what are they going to do? Are they going to sit there and to say, well, we can't really do much about it? Let's think about it. It's not about thinking about it, you know. Let people's wishes be heard. They might not support independence, but the most important thing is that peace agreement must be honored. That peace agreement must be completed. We're not going to be holding a gun by the people's neck and say, hey, you vote this way and that way. No, the people will decide through the ballot box. And again, to the Prime Minister of Papua New Guinea, the most honorable thing he can do is to let the people of Bougainville complete that process. Let the people of Bougainville decide.
And June next year is the date at the moment for that Bougainville referendum. The Deputy Speaker of the Bougainville Parliament, Francesco Somoza, there speaking to us here on Pacific Beats on ABC Radio Australia. Now, the Prime Minister of Solomon Islands, Rick Ho, has personally thanked Australia for its contribution to his country's security while calling for the deepening of economic ties between the two nations. As Michael Walsh reports, Mr. Ho's comments came in a speech delivered at the Australian National University in Canberra, where he was also questioned about the controversial underwater communications cable, which will eventually bring high-speed internet to his country.
Regional cooperation is a term that gets thrown around a lot by politicians, but Solomon Islands Prime Minister Rick Ho says it has a special meaning for his country.
For Solomon Islanders, regional cooperation goes beyond the abstract. For us, regional cooperation is real. We are where we are today because of regional cooperation spearheaded by Australia that saved us from ourselves.
The 14-year-long regional assistance mission to Solomon Islands had been the dominant force in Australia's relationship with the country, but that ended more than a year ago. Now Solomon Islands is looking to recast the bilateral relationship beyond the realm of peace-building efforts and development assistance.
We wish to pursue trade opportunities to supplement development assistance. In the long term, developing better trading arrangements hold the key to our sustainable development opportunities.
Mr. Ho said he was seeking a more strategic and long-term approach to seasonal work opportunities in Australia, streamlining the process for both farmers and workers. On the tourism front, Mr. Ho said the goal was to catch up to neighbouring Vanuatu.
Tourism has tremendous potential in Solomon Islands. We will explore an expansion strategy for cruise tourism with Carnival Australia. It is my intention that within 5 years, Solomon Islands will be where Vanuatu is today, with up to 6 cruise tourist ships to various parts of Vanuatu per week.
The Prime Minister also spoke at length about infrastructure investment in Solomon Islands, highlighting Australia's support for the Tina River Hydro Project. But the piece of infrastructure on everybody's minds has been the underwater internet cable linking the country and neighbouring PNG up to high-speed internet, ending their reliance on satellite connections. Mr Ho's predecessor, Manasa Sogavare, had previously signed a deal with the Chinese tech giant Huawei to build the cable, but that agreement was scrapped after Australia raised security concerns. Australia has since offered to pay for the majority of the project using aid budget funds. Mr Ho would not be drawn on the nature of those security concerns, but said the deal with Australia was a better deal for Solomon Islanders.
This project is going to make not only that efficiency of telecommunications in Solomon Islands, but we look forward to having telecommunications in Solomon Islands, cost of telecommunications go down, which is a very, very huge part of business costs in Solomon Islands.
His Australian counterpart, Malcolm Turnbull, also spruiked the potential benefits of the cable later in the day.
That is going to bring 21st century connectivity to Solomon Islands. And it is the tyranny of distance is being conquered by technology, and it's going to underline the very deep ties and strengthen them.
In a wide-ranging Q&A session after his speech at the Australian National University, Mr Ho was also quizzed about the number of women currently in the Solomon Islands Parliament. The answer was 2 members in the country's 50-member assembly. While Mr Ho said he personally liked women being in Parliament, he said it was not something the government could directly intervene in. He did, however, praise Lynell Tanengada's by-election victory last month, which saw her beat former Prime Minister Gordon Darcy Lilo.
The candidates that stood for that by-election, one of them being a former Prime Minister, and that seat was won by a woman, that's in Solomon Islands quite incredible. You'll never see that in Solomon Islands before. So I think this is an achievement for women in Solomon Islands.
See if that change continues in future years. Solomon Islands Prime Minister Rick Ho there, ending that report from Michael Walsh.
Pacific Beat on ABC Radio Australia.
Now, the Governor of Guam says there is a sense of relief on the island after North Korea agreed to work towards the complete denuclearization of the Korean Peninsula. The deal reached between Kim Jong-un and Donald Trump will also see the end of joint military exercises that have upset both the North Koreans and the Chinese in the past. Those exercises involve US forces based in Guam, and that situation in turn made the island a potential target for North Korean weapons.
As late as last August, the North Korean leader Kim Jong-un was threatening to launch ballistic missiles at the US Pacific Island territory of Guam. North Korea then fired a missile 2,700 kilometres over Japan. That distance is the equivalent of more than two-thirds of the way between North Korea and Guam. While such threats had been made before, this time, there was little doubt that North Korea had developed the capability to hit Guam 3,500 kilometres away. It was a nervous time for the island. Now, President Trump has pledged to park his Guam-based military assets in a gesture of goodwill to North Korean leader Kim Jong-un.
The war games are very expensive. We pay for a big majority of them. We fly in bombers from Guam. I said it when I first started, where do the bombers come from? Guam. Nearby. I said, oh, great, nearby. Where's nearby? 6.5 hours. 6.5 hours, that's a long time for these big, massive planes to be flying to South Korea to practice and then drop bombs all over the place and then go back to Guam. I know a lot about airplanes. It's very expensive.
Uchi Freedom Guardian is one of the largest military exercises in the world. Last year, the exercise ran for 11 days, involved 17,500 American forces and 50,000 South Korean troops. But so far, military commanders say they're yet to receive any orders cancelling this year's exercise. But they're not the only ones taken by surprise. Guam Governor Eddie Calvo got called from his bed in the middle of the night to rush to the Air Force Base for a meeting with President Trump. An excited governor told PNC News that he'd spoken to the president and said the bombers made Guam a target.
I said, Mr. President, the reason why Kim Jong-un was putting Guam in the crosshairs was our beautiful B-1 bombers that seemed to take those regular cruises to the Korean Peninsula. And he understood that. And he says, those are wonderful aircraft. But I think with those wonderful aircraft, I think Mr. President also believes that, hey, in order to build peace and to give, and this is what I assume, to give assurances to Chairman Kim as he moves towards denuclearization, you know, that the United States will also show a good faith effort to calm things down through maybe a less provocative acts such as B-1 bombers cruising around Korea.
And he said the island's population was relieved by the move towards peace.
And I said, well, there's about 165,000 people that have taken a big sigh of relief. And I told him it's nothing short of a miracle that 10 months ago, you know, there was the leader of Korea, North Korea, that was making pronouncements of a nuclear annihilation of our island. And now we have 10 months later a document paving the way that's signed by both for peace and denuclearization.
A much more relaxed Governor of Guam, Eddie Calver, than perhaps he was a few months ago, the reporter there, Bill Bainbridge. Now, just sporting matters, and the smallest of the football-playing nations in the Pacific, Tuvalu, are hoping that Fiji will come to their aid as they look to press a fresh case for being accepted as full members of FIFA. A successful bid would enable Tuvalu to compete in the World Cup, but in the meantime, the team have just completed their first international tournament outside the Pacific, on the other side of the world, and while the going was tough, they ended on a high. The FIFA World Cup is almost upon us, but over in England, the CONIFA World Football Cup has already been won and lost. CONIFA is the governing body for football associations that sit outside the FIFA family for all sorts of reasons, and in the case of Tuvalu, size is the issue. They're just too small for FIFA right now, without a stadium or enough hotels to meet required standards. But no team is too small for CONIFA, hence the invitation to London to take part in the alternative World Cup, where Tuvalu came up against sides from Europe, Asia and Africa. After some heavy defeats, Tuvalu were on course for a win against Tamil Eelam before they shipped 3 goals right at the death to lose 4-3. Then, in their very last match, a friendly against the Chagos Islands, they romped to a 6-1 victory. The president of the Tuvalu FA, Sosiala Tinalau, says he was very proud of his team's efforts.
We're very happy because we ended up winning the last game of the tournament. I knew that the boys have learned a lot. They've learned they shouldn't relax, you know, especially when somebody kicked them and then, you know, they stop. They also learn how to play on the artificial turf. It's so different.
Ola Bjokovol is the publisher of the Football in Oceania website, and he was in London to watch the Tuvalu team in action.
I think they fared as well as you could have expected. They came to London just days before the tournament, so there's probably some jet lag, at least for the first game. And they played two very strong European teams who both have players regularly playing in good leagues in Italy and in Romania. And with that, I think they did well against them, despite the heavy losses.
But does the football writer believe Tuvalu's appearance at the CONIFA World Cup will have turned heads at FIFA?
I'm not sure if this really helps in any way, shape or form, to be honest, because I'm not sure if FIFA cares at all about what anyone outside of FIFA does. But I like to think that it has helped create awareness that they're struggling to get into FIFA, that the common man has taken a bit more notice than they normally would.
Whether travelling to London has helped or not, Sosiala Tinalau says his country have definitely not given up on joining the FIFA family one day, and now he's looking to Fiji to provide a way forward as a neutral venue where Tuvalu could play regional and World Cup qualifying matches.
I think there's a new strategy that I would like to pursue, to talk to our neighbour, Fiji, if we could use their turf as our host country. They are FIFA member, so I hope that would be a strategy to pursue, and then we can submit our next bid.
I don't see any reason why they couldn't. In Europe, you have Gibraltar, who play their home World Cup and European Championship qualifiers in Portugal because their stadium isn't good enough. by that logic, then yes, that should be a thing that they could make happen.
In the meantime, Tuvalu are considering a plan to take the team to the Netherlands, and they're hoping to play a Pacific Derby match against their near neighbours, in Pacific terms at least.
Oh yes, I think we're going to play against Kiribati, and I'm not too sure about our aim to also come to the Netherlands. We are still in negotiation stage, maybe on the books, yeah, training camps in the Netherlands. And hopefully we can scout more players from New Zealand, because we have a diaspora living in New Zealand and also in Fiji.
And the hope is the match against Kiribati can be played this year and quite possibly in Fiji before Tuvalu travel to Samoa to compete in the Pacific Games in 2019. Meanwhile, the FIFA World Cup kicks off in Moscow overnight tonight, and as Bindi Bryce reports, among the crowd, there'll be a small group of children from the Pacific Islands who've been given a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity to travel to the other side of the world and experience one of the biggest occasions in sport.
To play at a FIFA World Cup is the dream of young footballers across the globe. But it's a dream that has long been out of reach for the Pacific Island nations, with Oceania's only representatives in the 88-year history of the tournament being first Australia and then New Zealand. So once again this year, the Pacific will be underrepresented, at least on the field. But when the hosts Russia open the tournament against the Saudis in Moscow's 80,000 Luzhniki Stadium, there will be a Pacific presence in the crowd, courtesy of the Reagan Milstein Foundation. Chief Executive Kevin Milstein says the Australian charity was formed to honour the memory of his 14-year-old soccer-loving son, who died after a diving accident while the pair were attending the 2010 World Cup in South Africa. And ever since, the organisation has been helping less fortunate children in Australia, the Pacific Islands and beyond. As part of their mission, they have selected two children from each South Pacific nation and whisked them off to Russia to see the 2018 World Cup firsthand.
These kids, in the most part, don't even have passports, or at least when we started talking to them, they didn't even have passports, so they've never even left their village, let alone their country. So for them to be able to experience, you know, literally the bright lights and the big smoke of a city like Moscow, and also to be at the World Cup, we would hope that they would be going back learning all sorts of different kinds of lessons that they could impart with their communities back at home.
Working with the Melbourne-based social enterprise Football Music Culture, the Reagan Milstein Foundation have brought a unique team together to take part in the Football for Friendship event at the World Cup. Kevin Milstein says 12-year-old footballers and aspiring journalists from more than 200 countries have been selected to go to Russia for the 8-day program, which will include workshops, football training and a small championship tournament. Not unnaturally, the excitement levels are rising for those children chosen to go to Russia, including 12-year-old Anita Loretta Hufanga from Tonga's main island, Tongatapu.
I was happy. I'm happy and so excited. When I was a little kid, I loved to play soccer. Go there every day. I'm looking forward to seeing new people, new places, and to have new playmates. I love to support Germany. Oh, they were the champions in the last World Cup.
Still full of running, and he's got some!
Another of the Pacific contingent is Haiyan Khan from Fiji, who plays football for Bar's under-12 representative team and has ambitions to play for his country one day.
I play midfielder and I love football. I'm very much looking forward to this game. I hope to make friends and report on social media. My favourite player is Neymar and my favourite team is Brazil.
Neymar into the 18, fakes left, cuts right, oh! Beats it off the underside of the crossbar, he is back and Brazil's in front.
Semisi Femisi from Apia in Samoa is hoping he'll catch a glimpse of his favourite player from Portugal.
Shocked and happy, just meeting everybody from different cultures, perhaps even one of the famous players. I play football and I follow Real Madrid.
Who's your favourite player?
Cristiano Ronaldo.
Ronaldo's still got the legs. Yes, look at him fly. Moves inside Ronaldo! Cristiano Ronaldo!
Kevin Milstein is hoping the trip to Russia will inspire the kids to go after their own World Cup dreams.
It's certainly a huge experience for them to take in, and it's part of that experience that they're going to see. How far can they get in the world playing sport? You know, it doesn't just have to be football. It could be any kind of sport. Once you commit yourself and, you know, you attend all your training sessions, etc., then you really can open up a lot of doors.
And with FIFA planning to expand the World Cup finals to a 48-team tournament in 2026, including a guaranteed spot for Oceania, the hope is that one of the Pacific Island nations might finally make it on to the biggest of all sporting stages.
That is it! Germany are the champions of the world for the first time since 1990.
And the 2018 World Cup kicks off 1 a.m. PNG time tonight, 2 a.m. in Suva, 4 a.m. in Apia. That's it from Pacific Beats for this morning. Thanks for your company. I'm Richard Hewitt. Hope you can join me for the next edition.